We're going to get started because we have lots of wonderful people to share their stories with you this morning, and we want to make sure that we give everybody enough time. Our panel is going to look at many things happening in education, but hopefully help you think a little bit about what's possible, probable, preferable, and preventable. My name is Yvonne Andres. I'm the director and co-founder of the Global SchoolNet Foundation. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that. To my right here, we have David Thornburg. I'm going to let each person introduce themselves because they will tell you exactly what they want you to know about themselves. And then to his right, we have Sarah Armstrong and Tom Abels. Okay, and we have a guest presenter down here in the audience, Stephen McKinnon, who's a local teacher who's been involved in some of these great projects that we're going to tell you about. Okay, just I want to tell you a little bit about Global SchoolNet in case you don't know about us. We've been around for a long time, but basically our niche and our focus is what we call collaborative learning or shared learning. So we create projects where kids connect with one another from around the world, and they share information, and they do problem solving together, they learn about each other, they study earthquakes, they study environment, they study world leadership, literature, art, culture, and so on. And I'm going to actually give you some real examples of some of these projects. And of course, the whole idea of having kids involved in that kind of an education is to benefit humanity and to have these kids be good global citizens once they're adults and they're leading our world. So just a couple more things, just to give you a little bit of our history. We've been around for a long time. We started back in 1983 as something called the FredMail Network. It was a distributed bulletin board system that ran on Apple IIe's and 300 baud modems, and we were connecting kids via text email only at that time. Over the years, we've evolved. We've gotten a number of sizable grants, starting with one from the National Science Foundation, and most recently a nice size grant from Microsoft from the Partners in Learning program to create something called the International Projects or Partners Place, or as we like to refer to it, the IPOP. And it's a place where educators can go to find these kinds of projects and connect with educators that want to do collaborative learning. We have a pretty big reach for an education organization, maybe because we've been around for a long time, but we do have 100,000 online educators that are involved in project-based learning, and we're in many, many countries, and we run many projects each year. So why are we into all of this, and why are we excited about this, and you know, what is society saying that sort of is giving the stamp of approval for this kind of learning, the future of this kind of learning? And there are a number of societal trends, but I pulled out the ones that I think most closely align with what we're trying to do and what we're trying to say. There is a strong emphasis on collaboration at all levels. Tell me where you go where you don't hear people talking about collaboration, about teamwork, about sharing resources. We can't do it alone. We've got to work together. You know, everybody needs to contribute. There's a growing consciousness that we need to think locally but act globally. I mean, that's a term that's been around for a long time, but people are actually starting to act that way. We're becoming independent. Business is being conducted online. Government is being conducted online. And, of course, entertainment is being conducted online. How many of you are involved in any of those things that you see up there? eBay, Amazon, Craigslist, MySpace, you know, iTunes, whatever. These are all things that, you know, didn't exist, you know, 5-6 years ago. And probably the most important reason that you need to be aware of this is that children have access to technology. Now, the report that's up there is actually 3 years old, and 3 years ago, 61% of U.S. kids had televisions in their bedrooms, 35% had video games in their bedrooms, 14% owned DVD players, and so on and so on. And a statistic that I heard yesterday was that most kids have these days at least 4 email addresses representing their different personalities. So maybe they have an educational one, and they have a social one, and so on and so on. So the echo boomer generation, as this is called, is very connected. And some of you might have caught, there was a news program done last year, I think it was on primetime or 2020, and they talked about the echo boomer generation. And I picked out a little clip from that program that I'd like to show you, and I'm going to have to do this. Thanks. See, we're collaborating right here.
If you've ever wondered why corporate America, Hollywood, Madison Avenue, and the media all seem to be obsessed with the youth culture, the answer is simple. The largest generation of young people since the 1960s is beginning to come of age. They're called echo boomers because they're the genetic offspring and the demographic echo of their parents, the baby boomers. Born between the early 1980s and the early 1990s, there are nearly 80 million of them. They're already having a huge impact on entire segments of the economy. And as the population ages, they'll become the next dominant generation of Americans. Who are they? What do they want? You'll be surprised. The oldest are barely out of college. The youngest, still in grade school. And whether you call them echo boomers, Generation Y, or millennials, they already make up nearly a third of the U.S. population and spend $170 billion a year of theirs and their parents' money. Almost none of it on boring things like mortgages and medication.
Have a good evening, guys.
And the world is falling all over itself, trying to sell them things.
Thank you.
What brands do you guys love?
Sony.
Patagonia. Gap. Gillette.
Aveda.
Only a small percentage are eligible to vote, yet they're already one of the most studied generations in history by sociologists, demographers, and by marketing consultants like Jane Buckingham of the Intelligence Group, who uses focus groups like this one to gather information for clients like NBC, Chanel, Nike, and Levi Strauss.
How much time would you guys say you spend on the internet a day?
A couple hours a day.
A couple hours?
Who would say more than TV?
Oh, yeah.
What do you like better?
Internet.
They're a reflection of the sweeping changes in American life over the past 20 years. The first to grow up with computers at home and a 500-channel TV universe. Multitasking, the cell phones, music downloads, and instant messaging on the internet. Totally plugged in citizens of a worldwide community.
Are you connected from the moment you get up?
Pretty much.
Oh, yeah. You have iPods?
Yes.
Of course. They're required by law now in the subways.
They're giving them away at Duke.
Totally plugged in citizens of a worldwide community. Did you catch that? Totally plugged in citizens of a worldwide community. Okay, I know there's probably a few academics out there, so what's the theory behind that? Well, the most recent education theory says that learning takes place better when it's constructivist, when students construct their own knowledge, where they construct artifacts that reflect what they have learned, where they share their knowledge with their peers, that learning is a social act, and there needs to be a continuous feedback loop where they get feedback from their peers. If you're not familiar with it, there's also an organization that's been created called the Partnership for 21st Century Learning. This is made up of executives and interested individuals from industry, from all the major industries, Intel, Microsoft, Sun, so on. And what they've done is they've identified what are the skills that students need to have that will prepare them for the workforce. And that's just sort of a summary there. Those are sort of the main components: global awareness, civic responsibility, project management, financial literacy, technology skills, and teamwork. So if you're involved in education, I ask you to look at your education systems. Are they currently teaching those things right now? Another little video here I'm going to show you on teamwork, which I found very interesting. Tell me if you think about if you would have guessed that this would be true about today's youth. I'm losing my little thing. Here we go.
same thing, that they're much different than their self-absorbed, egocentric baby boomer parents.
Nothing could be more anti-boom than being a good team player, right? Fitting in, worrying less about leadership than followership. You go into a public school today, teamwork is stressed everywhere. Team teaching, team grading, collaborative sports, community service, service learning, student juries. I mean, the list goes on and on. But one of the impacts that boomers had on...
Hal thinks they're more like their grandparents, the great World War II generation, more interested in building things up than tearing them down.
When you ask kids, what do you most hope to achieve there? Where they used to say, I want to be number one, I want to be the best. Increasingly, they're saying, I want to be an effective member of the team. I want to do everything that's required of me.
And you can already see some results. Violent crime among teenagers is down 60 to 70%. Tobacco and alcohol use is at an all-time low. So is teen pregnancy. 5 out of 10 Echo Boomers say they trust the government. Virtually all of them trust mom and dad.
So that surprised me. Some of those findings surprised me. I wouldn't have guessed that, especially if you read the newspaper, because you hear about all the negative things. So that's actually good news. Okay, so what's the message? The message, my message is, we will each have sort of different slant on this message. My message is that shared learning is powerful, that we need to move youth beyond using the internet as a library and discover how to use it as a collaborative tool. And quite frankly, I think youth are already there. I think it's the teachers that we need to move beyond using it to the library to using it as a collaborative tool. What I'd like to do actually is show you an example of a couple of projects that students have been involved with that will give you an idea of what's possible when students can communicate and collaborate with one another. One of the things that Global SchoolNet does is we specialize in connecting kids with real-time explorers, adventurers, scientists, people that are out there in the field and want to share their experiences with students virtually. And last year we were involved in a project called North Pole Solo, and there was a gentleman named Wave Vidmar who wanted to be the first American to travel solo to the North Pole, solo unsupported, carrying his 250-pound sled of supplies, skiing, swimming, trekking through to the North Pole, and the whole time sending back his reports and sharing his experiences with students. And after this event happened, we took the video clips from some of the schools that were watching this student, watching Wave Vidmore, and Wave's video, and he took the video of himself. So you have to imagine he's skiing and swimming through the North Pole, setting up the video camera, going back and doing it again. So it's not difficult enough doing this by yourself, but he's got to do it twice. Anyway, what I'm going to show you is a little video from this experience, just to give you an idea of what's possible.
I'm preparing for a solo expedition to the North Pole. I'm going to walk, ski, and swim about 660 miles from Russia to reach the North Pole.
He's attempting to be the first American to do it, not only solo, but unsupported.
It was something that I decided if I attempted it, the only way I'm coming home was after I've gotten to the pole. So, in fact, the only way I can come home is if I get to the pole. Being unsupported, there's nobody that's with me. I'm on my own. If I did get into trouble, depends on the severity of the trouble. Generally, I'm going to try and accomplish everything I can by myself, including even my medical situations that may arise. To go to the North Pole, here's what will happen. I'll fly across to Moscow, Russia, and then I'll make my way up to what's called Cape Artichesky. It's up in Shredny. It's the most northern point of land. And from there, I'm going to walk, ski, and swim the 660 miles from the Russian Cape to the North Pole. Once I get to the North Pole, I'm going to make a phone call with my satellite phone.
Well, hi there. I'm getting ready to call the Temple Heights School in Elementary School in Oceanside, California, and speak to Mr. Ramiro Santana's third grade class. It's a little noisy out. There's a storm still raging. It's snowing and it's quite windy. You might hear it from the tent, but I'm going to call via the satellite and talk to their class. And yes, hi. This is Wade. I'm calling from the North Pole for Mr. Santana's class.
Spoke to the Ein Ganim school in Israel and had a very nice time. It was really touching. I couldn't believe how much it impacted me, and I hope I impacted them just as much as they did me.
Okay, now we would like to sing something to you. Would you like to hear us sing? Okay, one, two, three.
Is there anything that you want? Is there anything that just call on me, and I'll send it along with love from me to you. I've got everything that you want, like a heart that's also true. Just call on me, and I'll send it along with love from
okay, that's just a short bit of that video, but a couple things. Right after Wave landed, a couple days after he landed, he broke his ankle. He duct taped it up and continued the journey with his ankle duct taped up. There were about 2,000 classrooms that were following him, exchanging information as he was sending back his reports. The archive of that's actually up there, so even though the expedition is over, teachers can go back and use that information and talk about and discuss those things. So that's just an example of one of the projects. There's hundreds. Two quick other projects I want to tell you about. One is something that we run for the State Department called Doors to Diplomacy. It's a competition for middle school and high school students anywhere in the world, international. Students work in small teams. They create projects about global issues, about world leadership, peace and democracy, economics, science and technology, foreign relations, health, environment, art and culture. The idea is for kids to look at these issues from different perspectives, depending on what part of the world they're in, give a picture of what those issues are, and make suggestions. So it's getting kids involved in thinking about the future of these important issues. It's a competition where the winners receive $2,000 scholarships. They're brought to Washington, D.C. They get special awards from the State Department and so on. This project is based on another one of our projects, which we've been running for 12 years, which is called International Schools Cyber Fair, and I'm actually one of our teachers that's been involved in this project for 12 years. We're going to talk about this project in a few minutes, so I'm not going to go into detail about that one. All of these projects have, all of our projects have certain elements that we feel are essential. They're conducted authentically through a project-based learning environment. There's reflective pieces, which we call our project narratives, critical thinking and continuous feedback through peer evaluation. They publish it on the internet so that it goes beyond just what's happening in the classroom and can be shared with kids all over the world, and the benchmark gets higher and higher because those projects are there, and then each year the new group of students does at least that good and better. There's a focus on local community but how it affects the world, and their intergenerational participation from these projects. Before I turn it over to Sarah Armstrong, who's going to tell you about even more great projects, I'm going to invite your help. I'm going to take this opportunity to invite your help. And if you're sitting in the audience and any of this sounds interesting to you, please think about becoming our partner. Help us to find funding and support to expand these programs to reach more youth worldwide. And anything else that you can think of. Thank you. Sarah, you want to plug yours in here? And this hopefully will take 1 second as we switch it on over here. And I'm pleased to introduce Sarah Armstrong, who is an amazing individual and also on the Global School Net School Board, among other great things.
Thanks, Yvonne. Is that working? Oh, David, amazing. Thank you so much. I am Sarah Armstrong. I've been in education for over 30 years. Are you hearing me okay? Is that happening? Okay. For over 30 years, 17 years in the classroom and overlapping, and then the rest of the time in professional development, working with teachers, school districts, states, organizations worldwide. And I want to start with a little story. It's about Elephant, who was going down the path to get some water one morning, and he saw something in the path a little ways away, a little bit of color. Wasn't sure what it was. He got up to it, and he kind of saw that it was a hummingbird lying down on the ground with his little feet up in the air. And he kind of nudged it. He thought it was dead. And hummingbird said, "Please don't do that." And elephant said, "Why are you lying in the road here? You could get stepped on. You're lying with your feet up in the air. I thought you were dead." The hummingbird said, "I hear the sky is falling, and I'm going to hold it up." Elephant said, "You are going to hold up the sky all by yourself?" And hummingbird said, "Probably not, but if everybody does their part, we'll succeed, and I'm doing what I can." So that's why we're all here, I think. We're focusing on future thinking in our talk this morning, and I want to start by having this work. Okay, maybe that's not going to work. Okay, let me just forget that, if I can go back. Yeah, okay, I'm going to shut that out and just tell you. Or we can do it this way, I think you can probably see it. So we're talking about four aspects, as Yvonne already said, the possible, the probable, the preferable, and the preventable. And I want to reiterate and introduce you to another group that's talking about 21st century skills, the Materi group. And they talk about four different ways to look at 21st century skills. The digital age literacies include the basic literacies of reading, writing, and arithmetic, as well as economic literacy, geographical literacy, visual literacy, all those kinds of literacies that are now so important for us all to know, and especially for kids. Inventive thinking includes being able to be creative, keeping your curiosity, maintaining that kind of interest and higher order thinking skills. The effective communication aspect includes, as Yvonne has said so eloquently, the importance of collaboration, of teaming, of being able to work together, of the responsibility that we take for our own social learning, as well as the global awareness and the global communication of kids. And the high productivity refers to quality products, high quality products, being able to manage and work through a project, manage it, and keep it go, have it work from beginning to end. The Materi Group. ThinkQuest is another organization that promotes collaboration on a global level among kids. It's a contest that's been around for quite a number of years where kids develop, in collaboration with kids from around the world, web pages to teach other kids some topic. The winner this year in the 19 and under group focused on the digital divide, the international digital divide. And the way they looked at it was to think about four different kinds of barriers that have to be crossed to solve or remedy the digital divide. They talked about the physical barriers, which has to do with access, having access to the tools and to the internet. The digital barriers they define more specifically as having access to software and online materials that speak to their languages, and have a respecting cultural perspective. The human barriers include those people who don't get why it's important for kids to work with technology, to be collaborative, and so on, and it requires that we help teachers have the information and the training to understand how important this all is. The socioeconomic barriers also, in their work, address the idea that it's important to consider how important it is for technology to be really, truly integrated into all the work that students have available to them these days because of all the reasons that Yvonne has said and because of the global situation in which we all live. Another project that I hope you know about or would like to know about is the My Hero Project, where students and adults from around the world have written stories about their heroes, posted them on the web, so shared them with a global community. There are also short film segments about heroes and an art gallery about heroes. And by the way, all of these projects are free, no cost to teachers or kids. We can't forget the Global SchoolNet, of course, Foundation, of course. You've heard a bit about Doors to Diplomacy, a bit about CyberFair, and you're going to hear some more from a practitioner very soon. And I'd like to encourage you to explore the work of the George Lucas Educational Foundation, if you haven't already, where what the foundation is about is looking at the good news in education globally and sharing the stories through film, through website, through magazine. Again, the magazine is free. The materials are available online. And I'm going to try to show you a little video as well. Let's see if we can do this easily. Of a project that I think speaks to the global issues that we've been talking about. Get it to come up. Oh, man. Okay. I'm going to try this one more time, and then I'll just go on if it doesn't work. I'm sorry? They're the best. Okay. The George Lucas Educational Foundation has been around for a number of years and, as I said, looks at the good news in education. The idea was there's so much about the bad news and the things that are wrong. There are lots and lots and lots of places around the world where things are going really well. So let's take a look at those. It's going well now, yes. So I want to show you quickly this short video. And I need to
see, now I got it spread out even more.
These third graders in Fairfield, California are helping to preserve a vanishing piece of local history.
How long did you have to train? for to be a real blacksmith?
You can learn basic blacksmithing in about 6 months.
Students at Tolinas Elementary School made several field trips to document the history and resources of nearby Sassoon Marsh and Rush Ranch.
Okay. Good.
They plan to share their findings online with classrooms across the country through what teacher Eva Lamar calls the Geoliteracy Project.
We wanted to do something where we could take our county, our history, our geology, our geography, and encourage students to become literate in it.
All of the content on the Geoliteracy webpage grew out of self-directed inquiry by Lamar's third graders.
We start with an essential question, which is, why was the preservation of Rush Ranch important? The students picked this area they wanted to research. They drove their own projects. The groups were looking at specific plants and specific animals.
That's called miner's lettuce. I don't know, it has a smell.
Groups looking at specific Native American issues.
Obsidian.
Very good.
It's like glass.
The blacksmith shop, and then the history of Rush Ranch from pre-Columbian all the way up to now.
Wow.
So our students became the authors, the photographers, the videographers, and the local historians working with high school students and historians.
Tule is a wonderful material that the Indians used, and the Indians made tule ducks.
We realized that we had some local experts, a retired teacher named Barbara Van Putten, who had all these wonderful materials. She had original arrowheads, she had original baskets, and you can't take those into every classroom. So my students invited her to come into class and bring all her Indian tools that she had and artifacts.
You're not going to pull this apart. Good, thank you.
Fairfield High School students helped the third graders produce object rotations by photographing artifacts from different angles to create a three-dimensional digital image.
My students were the experts with the materials, with the objects being photographed, and the high schoolers were the experts with the equipment.
Okay, one more picture.
So it was a very happy meeting of the minds.
Members of Armijo High School's technology club offered to capture video clips and virtual reality stills for the webpage.
Right now I'm working on the virtual tour for Rush Ranch, and basically the project will go on their website, and I'm trying to make the highest quality panorama that I can with what the footage that I took.
And I'm looking for something you learned, something that was amazing.
Lamar believes that by studying their local history, students can taste the joy of lifelong learning.
It might have been chasing like a salt marsh harvest mounds or something, because it showed like the footprints heading to the hill as if it were chasing something.
All of you know what this is, right?
Yeah, that's a horrible.
They developed a love for history. They look back at choices that were made historically. And they realize that this has a meaning to our lives. And that's what you really hope as a teacher, that you can get them to understand, is what they're learning now does have a meaning. It's not just a hoop they jump through. They develop a love for learning.
Using the Fairfield webpage as a template, Lamar hopes other communities will make their own geoliteracy sites.
Part of this project is the hope that we can take students anywhere in this country that we are studying and go to that community's geoliteracy site and look at their history, look at their topography, look at their geology.
If some of them did the same things as we did, we could learn different facts off of them and maybe add it to ours and show everyone what all of us have learned from off of each other. Yeah.
So working off of helping each other is, I think, a theme that we're going to hear throughout this morning and hopefully beyond. So again, future thinking, the possible. Online global projects are already happening, and they're a very, very powerful way for kids to learn about themselves, learn about each other, learn about their place in the global community. Very important. The probable, addressing the digital divide, as those young students from the ThinkQuest contest have so eloquently also researched and shown through their site. The preferable, in our very books here that we got for the conference, Tom Lombardi, Barbara Ray Gillies, and F. James Chatworthy talk about these very issues, the idea of action research, of wisdom, of passion for what it is that you're working on, very important aspects of education. And the preventable, I hope, is the dearth or the not having those 21st century skills, because we all have something that we can do to make that make the 21st century skills something that our students and our colleagues and everyone it participates in and grows with. So I want to close with just the idea that it's in your hands. If we each do our part, we'll all succeed, and wish you a delicious conference.
Okay, we're going to do another little technology switch here, and while he's hooking it up here.
It's done.
Yeah. And did we see something? Yep, great. We're going to switch here. And I'm going to turn it over to Stephen McKinnon.
Thank you, Yvonne. I am the face of the possible, I think, in this presentation. I'm here to share with you our experiences with International School Cyber Fair over the past 11, going into 12 years now. The slideshow will just take you through a kaleidoscope of our projects and what we've done. I am a high school teacher. I teach information technology at a small rural high school in eastern Ontario, a school of only 280 students, situated in a village of only 1,000. There's absolutely nothing special about my school in any way. We have been doing a variety of projects, international collaborative global projects. International School Cyber Fair is one that I have to say that I absolutely love. That's why we keep coming back to it. Yvonne asked me yesterday when we met for the first time why or how we chose to start to participate in Cyber Fair, and I had to scratch my head and think carefully about it. The reason is that I came into the web in 1995 as a teacher, and my initial reaction was that I did not want my students simply finding information and be consumers of information, although that is an important skill. I wanted them to be creators and to contributors to the web, so I was looking for something that fit that, and Cyber Fair arrived in my email box one day, and so we took it on. I have to let you know a little bit about the classroom. If you haven't been in a high school or an elementary school classroom in a while, we no longer sit in rows, in desks. The teacher is no longer at the front. It's a new world in the schools. The students are all over the place. It's project-based learning. It's student-led. So it is a very different environment. Our take on Cyber Fair may vary a bit from others. The general theme is share and unite. The challenge that we're given is to go out into our communities and document a group, an event, a specialty. There are a variety of categories, environmental, arts, and business groups, and so on. So there's a very wide range of possibilities there. But we are simply to go out and document it, create a website, and then the website goes into a contest. It is reviewed, peer-reviewed, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. And in the process, it unites hundreds, thousands of schools around the world who are essentially doing the same thing. As I said, my projects are student-led. I am not the manager or leader of the group. It's student-managed. Our projects are also a little different in that they are real projects. These are not just school projects. When you see Habitat for Humanity, that's the real website for our chapter of Habitat for Humanity. Canadian Aid for Chernobyl, that is the real Canadian Aid for Chernobyl site. I'm fortunate to live in a community with community groups who are willing to take the risk on letting high school students take on this kind of work. And every year we have a variety of clients. There's Claire working with the girls right now. And so my projects always start with a client meeting. Sometimes the students know who their client is going to be. Sometimes they don't. They just prepare for a meeting, and a client walks in and lets them know what kind of work they need done. This past year, my students actually had a list of about 7 potential clients to take on, and they got to choose which ones they did. They chose Habitat for Humanity. The teacher role is very different in this kind of environment. I am not at the front. I am not leading things. I'm a facilitator. I'm making sure the students have what they need, making sure that the students are working with their team. The students do a whole variety of things. There's one slide in there somewhere that lays them out quickly. They start by planning their project. A lot of planning has to go in to get all the pieces to go together. The actual start of the project is the client meeting, and during that meeting, the students have to listen carefully to question. They have to think. They have to record. They have to be liaison with the clients. They've got to carefully document the client's needs, what exactly their organization is. During the project, they learn a lot about these groups. Students may have been vaguely aware that Habitat for Humanity had built a house down at the bottom of the hill, but throughout the project, they learn much, much more about their community. The site plan, during the planning phase, the site plan is a critical piece to it. It forms a large piece of the blackboard in my room where the site is all planned out. Often the schedule of the meeting, the calendar is also planned out in that way. The design phase is takes on probably the largest amount of time, where the students carefully design what their target audience is, what the look and feel for the site is going to be, what the content is, the site, the organization, the navigation. They then go into the production phase where they actually build it, and a lot of organization has to go in at that stage. Throughout all of these stages, there are sort of checkbacks and meetings with these clients and community groups and members. Fixing the site and getting it perfect is the big push at the end. There's always a big push at the end. It's quite an unusual situation, and I explain it to my students, and they buy into it totally. 99% is not good enough in this situation. If you're making the site for Canadian Aid for Chernobyl, it cannot have a single spelling mistake in it. If you're making the site for Habitat for Humanity, it cannot be a broken graphic. So the bar is really raised quite high, and the students respond very well to it, largely because they are working for adults, for real people, and doing important work. CyberFair, we could be doing all of this anyways, and I probably would be doing it anyways, but CyberFair adds a lot to the process. It gives teachers a framework to work under. It's very well organized. The steps are laid out there. There are activities, questions, support material from the website that are very useful. By being a CyberFair entry, it also gives us a timeline, a push to be done. Deadlines become very, very important in the process. It also is certainly a great way to showcase our projects, to connect us internationally. The peer review, as I said, is a wonderful process. It happens at the end of the whole thing, so that our students are all finished their site, and then we take on the peer review of other sites. So there is again, excellent online resource. The peer review rubric is massive. It's about, 12 pages long if you were to print the thing out. It's very detailed, and the students take it very seriously to evaluate other sites from Poland or New Zealand or Taiwan that where students have gone out and done the same thing that they've done. What does this really mean to the students? I mean, having done it and gone through the process, like what are the students going away from this with? And I've had the opportunity to talk to a number of students over the years about what these kind of projects mean to them as soon as they're finished it, or maybe 5 years later, reflecting back on it. And it certainly, probably most importantly, is connected to the students to their own community. They learn a lot about their community. They become connected very directly with the community. And I think that's, as a teacher, that's one of the important things that I can be doing, is helping students connect themselves with their community. It creates a great deal of self-esteem within the students. They feel very valued by their community. For Habitat for Humanity to walk in and say, can you kids make our website for us, is a great affirmation of the value that our young people have. They feel recognized in a whole variety of ways by CyberFair, by their client groups. Our clients have found a variety of ways to recognize our students. The Cataract Way Conservation Authority took the students on a picnic at the end of their project. The Rideau Water Land Trust invited the students to their annual dinner and awarded them their Volunteer of the Year Award. Canadian Aid for Chernobyl gave us a wonderful trophy made of a Maruska doll. And there's all kinds of news media recognition from the students, and that's another sort of bonus side effect of it, is putting students in front of the news media and having to cope with that situation. There are other unexpected effects of this. 1 year, because of our CyberFair project, a group of my students chose to take on collecting donations for an orphanage in Belarus. It was the Canadian Aid for Chernobyl group who were putting together a container load of material to be sent off to Belarus, and my students took on the task of getting the box for the orphanage ready, and worked very hard on that part of the project. Creativity is one of the big things in projects like this. Students get to exercise their creativity and use a whole variety of their skills. And because I'm an IT teacher, I mean, IT skills are certainly the core of what we do, but it's a very interdisciplinary approach. Students who are good at other things, especially communications, become very valued within the group. Creativity is important, and they feel empowered to create. I mean, Habitat Humanity says make the site, and they really did not have any foregone decisions or requirements in terms of what it looked and felt like. Time management, I've mentioned deadlines before. Time management is a huge part of what the students learn, and when they come back after 4 years at college or university, they say that they learn time management for the first time in projects like this. And communication, students, someone yesterday said that this presentation that they did was the first time their students got to talk in their class. Well, students get to talk a lot and communicate a lot in my classes. The meetings are certainly a critical communication avenue. They use email a lot. They go on the telephone. Interviews, every CyberFair project always has a bunch of interviews with community members during the research phase. And probably most importantly, the students have learned the value of ideas. They know that the idea of what the community groups are is important, and the value of their own ideas in contributing towards them.
Thanks. That was an awesome, awesome job. Okay, we're going to do another technology switch here.
Okay. My name is David Thornburg, thrilled to be here today. This technology switch went really well this time because I'm not using either Mac or Windows. I'm running Linux. So I'm sorry, I just don't have time to deal with technology that doesn't work. So that's it. Anyway, it's great to be here. By the way, we just wrote a new book called When the Best is Free, An Educator's Perspective on Open Source Software. And I have a copy, and if you'd like it afterwards, I'd be happy to sell it to you. It's okay if several of you want it, because I did bring more. And also, it's available as a two-volume set. Now, both volumes are the same, but we like it when people buy the set. Anyhow, what I want to talk about is a global perspective on all of this, and thinking about the theme of what's possible, I think that, and we'll try to make the case for this, that what's possible is deep cultural understanding on a shrinking planet. And this has really been alluded to already quite nicely. What's probable is that some countries will move faster than others. As William Gibson said, the future arrived, it just wasn't equally distributed. Actually, one of the countries that's moving slower than others is your neighbor to the south, the United States. And so we'll talk about that. What's preferable, I think, is that children become global citizens. We've already heard that mentioned. And what's preventable, if we really do the job right, I believe, is global conflict. And I truly believe that. Now, one of the things that's nice in the Thornburg Center is we get to visit the schools all over the world. This is a classroom in Siem Reap, Cambodia, where Norma and I just were a couple years ago. It's an interesting school from a technology perspective because if we brought computers to this school, one of the first things we'd have to think about is electricity. And so that's on the radar screen, although there are parts of this town that do have internet access and whatnot, so we've got some interesting opportunities there. Our home base is in Recife, Brazil, and it has a view from our veranda. For those of you who haven't seen the ocean in a while, there it is, looking nice. And one of the things that's cool about Recife, we also live in Lake Barrington, Illinois. We split our residence between two countries. But this is a picture of the original island where Recife was founded in the 1600s. It was a major Dutch port, and then there was a war with Portugal, and the Dutch got pretty much kicked out. But in any event, this has now become a digital port. This island houses Brazil's equivalent of the Media Lab, and lots of exciting stuff going on there. So we get to hang out with some pretty cool folks when we're at home. One of the people that has had a huge impact on Brazilian thinking is this gentleman. This is Gilberto Gil. Some of you may know of his music. He's a very famous singer, performer. He's also the Secretary of Culture for the country of Brazil right now, and one of the founders of what's called the Tropicália movement. And I want to talk about this movement a little bit, because the idea behind this movement is that if you really understand another culture, you don't put it up on a pedestal and say, oh, isn't that wonderful? Go to folkloric ballets and say, oh, isn't that nice, and whatnot, and then go on with your life. If you really understand another culture, you can hack it. You can take pieces of it, incorporate it in your own, do neat things with it. And that embracing of cultures and deep understanding of cultures, I think, is part of the glue that's going to hold some of these goals together that we talk about. Tropicália is very much a xenophilic, not xenophobic movement. And it started, I guess, in the 70s. Is that right, Norma, about that? And the pieces of it still go on. And so the question is, well, what does technology have to do with any of this? This is a program I wrote in NetLogo based on the work of Professor Eglash at the RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, on ethnomathematics. This is a fractal pattern representative of the cornrow hair designs that are very popular in Namibia. And you'll see African Americans wearing their hair with cornrows. And a lot of the children who have their hair woven that way aren't aware of the mathematics behind it. And so by understanding a culture well enough, you say, well, you know, there's an entree to learning 20th century mathematics, which is another one of my bugaboos. We don't teach 20th century mathematics in schools. We teach, it's not that mathematics from before the 20th century is bad. It's not. It's just there have been some discoveries in the last 100 years that children maybe should know a little bit about. And so here's a way of exploring some of this stuff. So this is an example of of taking a piece of a culture and then using it in the context of an educational setting for a topic like mathematics. And the idea is that students themselves would be creating these programs. That's the critical element, that the students are doing the heavy lifting. Gilbert Dagil said, a global movement has risen up in affirmation of digital culture. The creative impulses of people need access to the digital world. And so the question is, how does that happen? How do we make it happen? I think the only way it's going to happen, quite frankly, is through the growth of open source software, software that's free for people to modify and localize for their own needs, and also, in many cases, also free commercially so that you don't have to pay for it. And here's why. If you take a look at, Microsoft's model of operation and include Adobe and everybody else, when you put a computer in the hands of a child, you have as many dollars in the software as you have in the hardware. I mean, it's very, very expensive. And if you were to move to operating systems like Linux and other programs, Open Office, things of that sort, you can reduce your software expenditures quite a bit and still buy some proprietary software if you need it, but use that money to get even more access to technology. We talk about a technology revolution in the United States as if we have really done something significant with the children in the U.S. And I'm going to suggest to you that we haven't begun to have anything close to a technology revolution in the United States in schools. Let me show why I say that. This is a plot from the U.S. Census Bureau that shows student-computer ratio. Excuse me, this is from the National Center for Educational Statistics from the United States that shows student-computer ratio over time. And in the 80s, it was 65%, and today it's 4-1, four students per every computer. And here's the sobering thought. It has been 4-1 in the United States for the last 4 years. Now, what's happened to the price of computers in the last 4 years? They've dropped by more than a factor of 2. What's happened to the performance of computers? They've improved by more than a factor of 8. Okay? So none of the price elasticity theories or anything else would suggest this curve. It has flattened out. We have 25% penetration. I'm sorry, 25% is not a revolution, my friends. 75%, now we're getting close. We have not in the United States begun to see what the impact of technology could be in the hands of children, excepting in their bedrooms. Because in their bedrooms now, it's 51%. Okay? So a child is basically twice as likely to have meaningful access to technology at home in the United States than he or she is in a school. Schools are quickly becoming one of the few places in society where you can go and be basically isolated from the rest of the planet. That is the reality in the United States of America. It is also the reality in the rest of the world. So we have a long way to go. And easy for us, I'm a technologist, it's easy to get excited. But don't lose sight of this, okay? Who's doing anything about this? Well, this is Hector Ruiz. He's the president of AMD Corporation, one of the big chip manufacturers in the United States. He's from Mexico originally, educated, got his PhD in the U.S., and running this big company. And he created something called the 50 by 15 initiative that basically says within 15 years, he's going to have half of the people on planet Earth wired and access to the Internet. And that is his objective. And his view is that digital inclusion is about empowerment, not charity. Technology has to be accessible to people on a regular basis. And you have to take a geosensitive approach. So what works in country A may not be what works in country B, even to the details of what the computer looks like. The project has to have an integrated end-to-end ecosystem in terms of how this technology is implemented and how it's recycled, everything else. And if he's successful in this goal, by the year 2015, half of the world's population will have meaningful access to technology. And that's kind of an interesting goal, and he's pumping a lot of money into this. Intel is doing a similar thing, pumping $1 billion into this effort globally. It's just been announced, called the World Ahead Project. One of the things AMD is doing in Brazil is they have these time saver centers in communities that are just walk-in computer access. Anybody come in off the street, sit down, do whatever you want. Okay? free access. And so this is a way of reaching out to communities before they can get the technology in the hands of individuals. Well, at least make these centers that people can go to and do neat stuff in. And what do people do when they do get online? They create communities. There's been a lot of talk in the U.S. about MySpace. In Brazil, one of the popular communication, collaboration, and community building environments is called Orkut, which I believe is operated by Google. Is it not? I'm pretty sure that Google has a piece of that. And my wife, Norma, who's here today, was the headmistress of a school in Petropolis, Brazil, a long time ago, and the students from that school built an Orkut site, and they stay in touch with each other. Now, these students now have children of their own, but they still communicate with each other, and they're using the Internet to do it, and it's amazing because when you take a look at the stories that these kids tell and find out where they're from, and of course, they're not kids anymore, but they're scattered all over the planet. So there was a cluster of people that were located in the town of Petropolis outside of Rio de Janeiro, and suddenly now they're all over the world, but they still talk about those days. They communicate with each other. That's what MySpace is about. That's what Orkut's about. That's the power of this. And no grown-up had to tell them to do this. That's another critical thing. Teachers aren't telling kids, go do this. They don't have to. Number one, many teachers don't know to do this, and the kids themselves are doing it. And by the way, one of the countries it has really exploded is in South Korea. There's a tremendous amount of work. I just found out about that this last week. We're doing some research on what they're doing. So this is all interesting stuff. Now, we take a look at the technology landscape. We say, well, how are we going to put hardware in the hands of every child on the planet? MIT has an approach that some of you have heard about, the one laptop per child approach, which is this. This is actually an old prototype. They no longer have the generator on the side. They solved that electricity problem by saying, well, you can crank this for 12 minutes for a couple of minutes and get 45 minutes of power. Now the crank is on the transformer adapter. So if you don't have a place to plug it in, you crank there. Because this was breaking off. But anyway, it's an interesting concept. It's a very underpowered machine. So this, in our view, this technology as it exists today is probably not going to be successful. India just announced that they are not going to use this system, for example. That just came out. Intel, on the other hand, has taken a different approach. This is called the EduWise computer, and it's an open source platform. They will give the plans, the blueprints of this machine to anybody who wants it, in any country. Just go make your own and buy any volume that you want. Very inexpensive laptop, $300, $400 at today's prices, amazingly rugged and whatnot, and very powerful machine, the sort of machine you'd be willing and want to use yourself. This, of course, has put the fear of God into Dell and Gateway and all of the other box manufacturers because they realize they have to lower their prices. And if you've noticed, you can now buy an amazingly powerful laptop for $500 U.S. if you, shop around. Well, $600 for sure. Okay. Just very quickly to wrap up, if you take a look at where the electric grids are, and I love this picture from NASA. It's a simulation if the entire, if the sun were to go dark, what the planet would look like. But every place that's lit up, of course, has electricity. And it's important as you look at this map to realize that the Internet actually reaches the places that are dark. So you could be not on the power grid. You could actually be running on batteries with satellite phones like they were up in the North Pole and still be connected. So I think that the goal of having children connected with peers across the planet in terms of cultural awareness and understanding and having that be a powerful force for peace is realistic, it's doable, and it's something that I hope to see in my lifetime. So with that, I think it's 12 minutes, and let's move on.
We have one more panelist. Tom is going to talk to you, and then hopefully you'll stay around and ask us some questions, and hopefully we'll have some answers for you. And Tom tells us he doesn't have to use technology to deliver his talk. He's going to use his microphone. Yeah.
Am I on? Oh. In fact, I'll get behind the counter. My talk is here, and it's been modified in real time based on the remarks that people have been talking about. David was talking about the cheap computers. I just need to make a couple of introductory remarks. I've been working with a community college in Iowa that started out with desktop computers, went to what? Laptops, went to what? Palm Pilots, and guess what they're going to now? Anybody? Brain, of course. We hope those are engaged. They're cell phones. They are working with Microsoft. Cell phone is going to be the universal computer. Everybody says, but how do you have a computer with this little bitty screen that my cell phone right here has? And I don't know how many people know the kids are plugged into iPods watching what? Movies on that little iPod screen, which somebody said nobody is going to look at. So what we've got now, we have to think about this, is all of us here are probably over 21, and we're all digital immigrants, as my friend Mark Prensky coined the term. The people that are coming up that we're working with, because everybody talks about the students being driving the classroom, are what he calls digital natives. So all the technology we're designing and things is coming from our head. We need to start listening more to the kids and seeing what's happening, and I think this community college is doing wonderful things. I'm an ex-academic. I resigned tenure 30 years ago. I found my colleagues politically liberal and intellectually conservative, and I started my business. Yvonne started with a 2E. I started with a 2+ with 48K memory. Now, anybody who writes an email now, look at the size of your email. Your email is probably larger than the memory that I had to start a business with a word processor and VisiCalc, which was the equivalent of the early spreadsheets. I'm going to talk a little bit differently in terms of the technology, and since I'm not using that right now, I've worked with kids in watersheds and real-world projects, very similar to what we've been talking about here with Habitat for Humanity, and been involved with networking of kids on watershed projects around the world, connected very similar to what Yvonne's talking about, and in an institution that has had Project North, Africa Trek, and a variety of these things where kids get involved with people around the world in the Jason Project and similar things to that nature. The probable, possible, preferable, preventable four P's that we're starting with started with the conversation that Yvonne and I had last year. I want you to think about those for a minute, because probable, possible, or ideas about what the future can be. Preferable, preventable are actionable items that we have some control about what that future, how we might change the future. And I want to add one more P to this to think about that, and that is the philosophical. That has to do with the ethical, the metaphysics, and we now know that there's cyber, in terms of cyber cafes around the world, there are now what are called philosophy cafes, and they've got kids from kindergarten to us old folk who are busy talking about these kinds of issues, which have to underpin the issues of technology. And let me give you a couple of examples. One of the watershed projects that we were involved with was driven by kids in the whole community, which they started on their own with some help from a university to back up the testing they were doing. And the Corps of Engineers in the United States wanted to put dams in there, build concrete, and we know all about these things. And the kids went out and studied the culture of the community as well as the technology, the entire system, systems thinking. And what they found was two things. One of them they found is the majority of the pollution that the Corps of Engineers wanted to start was due to the problems of the dairy farmers allowing their cows to break down the stream banks, which caused the problem of silting, which is what the engineers wanted to fix. So all you had to do is keep the cows out of the river. The other thing they found out, which is more interesting from a political and a personal point of view, was that there was pollution in the river, E. coli, which means, you know, basically bacteria. And they traced it upstream because there was a big cheese factory. So who was going to cause the problems? A cheese factory? Well, some student went above the cheese factory and measured it and found out that the majority of the pollution was caused by the septic systems that all the citizens of the community had, which had pipes that went directly into the river. So here are students working with government, completely changed a Corps of Engineer project and opened up an entire civic community problem in terms of how people were handling their own waste within the community. So these projects have impacts that we really need to think about. And when the minute you get the electronics, we've got a global world where what you do now, you know, it's the butterfly effect that everybody has talked about, affects people across the planet. And we need to start thinking systems about this and the kinds of impact. A good friend of mine was on a safari in Africa, and they started going across the Sahara Desert, this area here, and it was a time of severe drought. And the guide said to them, we've got water in our vans for the trucks and vehicles and for you to get from point A to point B. That's all the water we've got, you know, maybe a little plus or minus. And he says, but you're going to meet people going across, as we trek across here, who are going to ask for water. If you give it to them, we won't have enough to make it across to the other side. The reason there was a problem was the drought, of course, but also because some wonderful agency of the government, international, had decided that malaria was a tremendous health problem, had sprayed to get rid of the mosquitoes, which did what? Gave a higher survival rate in Africa, which put extra population pressure on it. So everything that we're doing that has good intentions have other issues, and the global amplification via technology is our issues that we have to start thinking about on a much, much broader scale. Now, I have run an exercise for many years with everything from school kids to senior citizens. And we're going to play, we can do it anywhere. We've done it everywhere from, you know, like a week where we take sessions and we cover the wall with papers, and we've run it in a few hours. Since I've only got 12 minutes, I can't run the full exercise, but we can think our way through it since it's bright-eyed, it's early in the morning, you guys are rested. So I want you to think about this exercise, and we'll just run it through in your head. Okay, and it's pretty simple. And the thing is to say, okay, we are here today in the world, and it's got all the problems that we're facing. Now, let's say we could design a perfect world. And so we have to start making a list. So you could actually take a piece of paper out, and you could write down end disease, end war, nutrition, and as our mind goes, we end up with a whole room full of wonderful, wonderful ideas. There's no barriers to doing this. The next step is to say, okay, we've got about 25 or 30 people in this room. We're all different. Let's don't say of all these 200 things that we got, let's just take 10. Which 10 should we choose? And we can do it by consensus. Okay, what does that mean? That means we don't all have to agree except in a general idea. This sounds like futurists doing a Delphi or something like this, right? So we get 10 of those all put together. And I say, okay, now how do we go from where we are today to a future where we've got those 10 things? Okay? Now, the bottom line I'm going to ask of all of you is, how do we get from here to there, assuming that we've done that exercise? What's your answer? Anybody? Yes, ma'am. Okay. Okay, so we make thoughtful choices. Okay, let's say we've made the thoughtful choices. How do we implement them? How do we do that? How do we actually go? You know, it's like Congress trying to pass a bill in the United States or the Canadians settling on a government, you know, that's liberal or conservative. I don't know what Tarper is. I've got all these powerful brains in here. I'm looking for just a simple answer. Anybody?
We create a plan.
We create a plan? Okay. And how do you put the plan into action, Yvonne?
We figure out what the tasks are. We assign jobs. We create a timeline. We do risk analysis. Start doing things.
Okay.
Need a leader.
Need a leader? Anybody else? Yeah. Yes.
You just make it possible for people to say, this is what I want to do.
Simple.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. A learning model. That's great. That's a great idea. Okay. Anybody else?
Give them an example.
Give them an example. Okay. Keep going. I've had... Pardon? Somebody else?
Timeline.
Timeline? Okay. Anybody else? I don't... Panel up here of experts invited to sit at the front of the room. I've had one... consistent answer. These answers here are really good, and I've had similar ones come out only after I've done a workshop on complex dynamics and chaos theory, because the world is dynamic and changing. But of all these things I've run over n number of years, and I've got gray hairs to show that I've got a few years, one answer. They're looking for some deus ex machina. They want God to come down, pick us up out of our sandbox, okay, clean up the sandbox, put a fresh diaper on us, and put us back. There is a lack of faith that we as human beings are able to affect some change that's going to lead to a positive world. It's almost, you know, it's an interesting idea as to whether you can take enlightenment philosophy where human beings are able to organize their society in a way that makes sense as opposed to either getting a better world in an afterlife or just giving up that we can't get anything done without some benevolent leader to come down and take it over. In the United States, Ben Franklin said, what did he say? If you give up a little freedom for security, you deserve neither freedom nor security, the kinds of things like this. And yet, this is what the default situation has to be. So if we're dealing with all these projects, the answers that you have presented here are some of the most exciting opportunities to get these digital natives to be able to communicate, to think about the issues. But there is a book, a very thin book. It's an essay by Robert Bates Graeber. It's called Valuing Useless Knowledge. And the book opens up, and I'll paraphrase this, with the first thing that a parent does not want to hear, when their child comes home at the end of their freshman year in college, they do not want to hear the phrase, guess what, Dad and Mom? I'm going to major in liberal studies. On the other hand, he says, he ends the book, he says, liberal studies may be humanity's cry to save itself. And when we talk about technology, we forget that the humanities and the larger issues are the critical issues that need to be integrated with these kinds of ideas that come through. Yes, ma'am? Was Robert Bates Graeber. Now, I'll give you another interesting example along those lines. Earl Shores is an editor of Harper's Magazine, and he was looking at the causes of poverty in the United States. And he was looking for, can he come up with a solution? Obviously, he gets an article, gets published in Harper's and a few other things, but he was more interested in this. And he couldn't come up with any answer, so he decided to ask the people that were in those situations, people in the streets, people incarcerated, the whole nine yards. And he got a very interesting response, which was best exemplified by one of the women he interviewed in prison. And she said to him, "You have to teach us the philosophy," is what she said. And he thought about that and talked with her for a while. And the reason she said that was the same reason that all of us here are able to communicate. If you don't have the language and the skills to communicate, the vocabulary, the ability to articulate those ideas that are important to you, to other people, you can't sit at the table and help make decisions. So what he did was he wrote a book called New American Blues and an article in Harper's which was called In the Hands of the Restless Poor. But what he did is he got all his friends in New York City from Columbia and Barnard and NYU and all those to teach a course in philosophy, hardcore Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, etc., Descartes, to about a dozen, well, actually I think it's about 18 or to 20 people off the streets. The only thing he gave them was these lectures, sandwiches when they showed up, and car fare. There was no financial incentive. About half of those people eventually graduated from Baird College. And the program was picked up by Notre Dame and several other universities. But what it's basically saying is when we forget about technology, and I'm a chemist, as I said, I love this sort of stuff. I've been involved with computers and distance learning, and I consult to Bangladesh and et cetera, on those kinds of things, is that we have to deal with the soul and the heart, and we have to deal with the humanities, literature, and get people talking about, as I think we were talking about music and those things. So thank
I think
you.
That's a good place to give us just a few minutes. All these wonderful people have stayed to the very end. So usually I say, are there any questions? But I'm going to have questions for you. I have two questions. Did you hear anything that excited you? And did you hear anything that concerned you? So does anybody want to answer any of those questions? Did you hear anything that excited you from any of us? Did you hear anything that concerned you? Yes. So I think I agree with you. I think that one of the approaches is blending, so that you have the interpersonal skills, the one-on-one interpersonal skills, and you can function online because you're going to need to do that to learn and to work and so on. So absolutely, you can't forget about one set of skills and just learn the other set of skills. So that's an excellent point. Did you want to say something? Yes. Oh, you just saw the tip of the iceberg, believe me. Exactly. Well, I think if we're serious about making learning and education a part of future thinking, it needs to be a general session. It needs to be a captive audience, and everybody needs to be seeing and hearing some of these things that are going on. That's just my opinion. Anything else? Yes. That concerns me, too, and that's exactly what I'm seeing in so many places, especially in the United States, around the United States, and it's moving in the wrong direction. It's moving to supporting the skills-based learning that has no connection to the real world.
I just had a thought.
David. Yeah, I'm going to circle back to the comment that this gentleman said. I think that the major change has to come in the administration and the support of the administration and the policy. And there needs to be a pervasive recognition that these 21st century skills that we're all talking about need to be part of the formal education system. It's not there yet. What you saw is not happening around the world, everywhere. It's just happening in small little pockets by innovative teachers, most of who are doing it subversively because they know it's important and have been doing it. And I don't know, maybe Stephen, you might want to address that at your school. How is this supported? Does the administration encourage and support it?
I want to make a comment on that, if I could. Let's talk about librarians for a second before talking about teachers. I think there's two kinds of librarians. There are librarians who see their job as conservators of the collection, and others who see themselves as wanting to share the collection with as many people as possible. And there's places for both kinds of librarians. But they have very different underlying philosophies. And I think the same thing is true with educators in general. There are educators who really want to reach out and put the heavy lifting in the hands of the children. And there are other teachers who are very justifiably proud of their own content expertise and see themselves as the deliverers of that content for the supposed benefit of the students. And that's a philosophical issue that has been with us as long as education has been with us. And technology doesn't contribute anything to it, excepting perhaps bring some of these things into sharp focus. So there are some people entering the teaching force in the United States, I can tell you, who are neo-Luddites. When I was doing pre-service work at College of Notre Dame in Belmont, California, I had students who would, and I was teaching a technology course, and they saw it as their job to suggest that these tools had no value at all. And that had to do with their own personal philosophy of what they thought education was like. And I realized that there are some people who go into education because they love students, and there are other people who go into it because they liked school. And they liked school as they remembered it, as they romanticized it, and whatnot. Over time, I think we're starting to see some shift, and that's a very positive statement. But I've also encountered teachers in their 60s and 70s who are avid users of technology, just can't get enough of this stuff because of what they see it doing for the children. And tragically, I've seen teachers in their 20s who are happy to use the tools themselves but are not happy when students have access to it. So I think we have to be aware of that and how we encourage the next generation of teachers and help them see the opportunities that are there with these tools, because the kids know what the opportunities are and they're going to take advantage of them for sure. So it's an interesting world we live in.
Okay, well, I personally want to thank you all for sticking out to the very end. That's quite a compliment. So thank you, and feel free to, you know, chat with us. We actually have a little exhibit table set up in the exhibit area if you want to learn more about any of these projects. Like I said, this is just the tip of the iceberg. So thank you. Thank you all for coming.